This talk is called Seeking Justice Through Politics, and my name is John Marty. For brief background, I'm a state senator in Minnesota and very concerned in believing the Christians have to be concerned about how to do justice, and that a major part of how we do justice is through the political process. What is justice, to start this out? I saw in the reference room a brochure from the former LCA, so it's several years old, which it defines justice for all God's people. I don't understand, it says, and here they then describe it. Justice may be described as distributive love. It's what God's love does when many neighbors must be served with limited resources. Justice is the form of God's creating and preserving love, as that love is mediated by reason and power through persons and structures in community life. Injustice dehumanizes life and prevents full participation in co-humanity. Justice is therefore viewed simply as that which people need to be human. And I think we all have, while that definition is a little bit hard to catch right away the first time, I think we all have a concept of what justice is and what fair treatment of people is. And we've discussed social justice and economic justice as major aspects of it. And certainly we have many injustices in the world that we are at least aware exist. Whether we want to be aware of the specific circumstances or not is one thing. Human rights, civil rights, the fair treatment of people regardless of their race or background or whatever, providing decent jobs and economic opportunities to people, peace may be called justice in some ways, a whole range of things that we can talk about is justice that we should be working for. Victims of injustice, why do we have to work for justice? Because victims of injustice are usually victims because they're unable to do anything about it. They are often the least able to address their own situation. That's not always true, and they can be, in many circumstances, unable to promote their own interest and to fight for their own rights. But in many cases, they need help from outside the world. In terms of economic justice, I think a lot of people were told early on in the capitalist system, Adam Smith talked about an invisible hand in the marketplace that was going to make everything work out, and everybody is supposed to be concerned just with their own economic well-being, and everything else will take care of itself. The invisible hand that guides the market will take care of problems that may exist. But unfortunately, as much as that theory sounds good, it doesn't always work out that way. Free market has great imperfections, and a regulated free market is what we see ourselves, or most people in this country see ourselves as appropriately having, one that fills in the gaps that the market does not take care of. When some CEOs of corporations earn 300 times as much as their lowest paid workers, you have to question, I question, whether any one person is worth 300 times as much as another person in terms of what they contribute. They may have better talents, they may have great skills, but in the long run, are they worth that many times that to society? And for those who want to make the argument that, oh, the market does reward people for what they're worth, what about people who are paid, have a good job in a manufacturing plant, $15, $20 an hour job, they're working there, been doing it for many years, is there seniority builds up, they get higher wages and they work up the pay scale, and then overnight the plant closes down. 300 jobs lost. They are worth, according to the theory, they are worth $17 an hour because that's what they're getting paid, and certainly the employer doesn't choose to overpay them. Now they are out on the street with nothing to do, and maybe if they're lucky they will find a new job, maybe one that pays more. Most current practices, any indication, tend to find jobs that pay much less. Some can't find jobs at all. Sure, some can move, but not everybody can move. There are two-income families, and there are lots of reasons people can't just pick up and move, sell their house if they have it. So just because a factory closes doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be able to do it. And somebody who has a $17 an hour job and the next day is unemployed didn't all of a sudden lose their talents and their skills and what they can contribute to society. The market fails to meets, the market is not a perfect market. It does not pay people exactly what they're worth in contributing to society. It does have its flaws, and that causes some of the many injustices. I'd like to, as an example of the needs of, for working through the political process to solve injustices, look at the situation of migrant workers. As I mentioned, people who are victims of injustice often are voiceless in the political process, and they, migrant workers, are perhaps about the most voiceless because they tend to move around. They have no base as a home community in many cases, no political voice whatsoever. They're not registered to vote. They don't participate. And I wanted to read, I was reading the other day, Robert Coles' book on migrants, sharecroppers, and mountaineers, just a little bit to get a sense for what it means for people, victims of what I would call injustice here. And when he's just, his introduction starts by talking, and I'll read just for about 2-3 minutes. For 9 months, the infant grows and grows in the womb. The quarters are extremely limited. At the end, an x-ray shows the small yet developed body quite bent over on itself and cramped. Yet a whole new life has come into being. For some hundreds of thousands of American migrant children, that stretch of time, those months, represent the longest rest ever to be had, the longest stay in any one place. From birth on, moves and more moves take place, quick trips and drawn-out journeys. From birth on, such children, it is travel and all that goes with travel, forced travel by migrant farm workers who roam the American land in search of crops to harvest and enough dollars to stay alive, to live half right. How, in fact, do such children live, the boys and girls who are born to migrant farmers? To begin with, many migrant children are not born in hospitals, not delivered by physicians, or even carefully trained midwives. Again and again, the migrant mother will casually describe the work she does in the field all during pregnancy, the travel she undertakes during that same period of time, and finally the delivery itself, done in the rural cabin, or yes, done on the road, or even in the fields. However indifferent one may be to the cause of such people, it's hard to accept the fact in the second half of the 20th century, in the United States of America, women bear their children on the side of the road or in a one-room house that lacks running water or electricity. In either case, attended by a friend or neighbor or relative who's able to offer affection and sympathy, but not medical care. And then one more little bit about that. One woman who he was describing, he had met with several times over the years. She had never been to a doctor in her life, and her mother said, while she had delivered kids without being in a hospital, the mother thought she deserved to be in a hospital. And she talked about being scared of going there. When we asked to see the doctor and I said I was hurting and there'd be a baby soon, the way it looked, the nurse said, who was my doctor? My mama said there wasn't any. Then the nurse said that was too bad, and do we have a deposit for a bed? And it was a lot, more than we ever see, and we said no, but we tried to pay the bills we ran up and as fast as possible. Then she shook her head and she said it was too bad, but we should hurry on to the other side of the county, to the county hospital, and that was where we might get in, though she wasn't sure. But her hospital, it was an all-private one, and you couldn't go there except if a doctor brought you in, or if there was money, and only then could she call a doctor and ask him if he'd come over and take up the case. So that's what really happened. We went back, and it was good that I had my girl real easy, like my mama said. The next time we tried another hospital, but it was the same thing. So after that, we knew what to expect, yes, sir. You get to know about these things after a while. She had learned something, learned a lot actually, ignorant, barely able to write her name, never a reader, without a diploma of any type. Yet she had figured out how certain private hospitals are run, what criteria they demand before a potential patient, however much in pain and in serious medical difficulty, becomes an actual patient. That's just for a little flavor of what many people in our country live like. Certainly migrant workers are not the only ones, but they certainly have a rough time. Basic health care needs neglected, educational opportunities very slim, children moving around all the time, many times violations of child labor laws, and they're actually doing work they're not supposed to be doing. But clearly, they are victims of injustice. They don't have a decent life opportunity in the way that we see a need for people to have basic needs. We, as Christians, see Micah's call to do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with our God. How do we do this justice? We certainly all know, and the church has been involved over all the years in benevolence or charity. we work, many of our churches are involved in local food shelves, other sorts of things to help people like this who don't have the money to pay the bills. Certainly not just food shelves, but medical clinics for migrant workers have actually been set up using that by churches, but we recognize that there are ways we can provide charitable help to help people in need. But that's not doing justice, and that's not all that people need. It can fill in the gaps. But what migrant workers need is a job that pays them decent wages, that gives them safe working conditions so they're not stuck out in the field when the spraying, aerial spraying of dangerous pesticides is being done. They need educational opportunities from their kids, and as this widow vignette said, they need health care and some basic forms of health care. Where do we work for justice? Well, if I want to help that woman, I suppose I could track down one of her employers, and she doesn't have anyone for a long time, and advocate for her to that individual. If I can find that person, am I going to have much luck? Probably not. He's part of the system that exists. One farmer isn't going to be able to change the whole system and couldn't afford to provide health care benefits the way things are set up. His prices wouldn't compete with anybody else. If everybody else doesn't provide the same thing, they don't have a chance to do that. We could have, and migrant workers can, organize and work together to demand better conditions, but that's a very tough thing to do. Migrant workers have been, or farm workers have been organized somewhat in California and throughout the country with very limited success, and that's one part of it. But certainly not every farm worker is going to be organized, not everyone's going to have a decent right that way. So at a certain point, the political system has to step in and say, the market doesn't take care of every basic need that we, I think most of us consider a right, that people in our country ought to have, some of these basic needs. If we believe these things are rights that people should have, and if the market system one way or another doesn't fill it in, then we have to get involved in the political process. And there are several ways that we do get involved. And we as individuals can be involved, though certainly collective work on behalf of justice works better than working one-on-one. There are two ways that we work to change the political system, one of which is choosing who is in the office who makes the decisions, and the second one is trying to persuade those who are already in office or are going to be holding office to do what we think they ought to do. And in terms of the persuasion of those in office, I believe that under our democratic system, the role of the public official is not to take a poll of their constituency every time and try and determine from that what 51% of the public wants and do that, but they're supposed to weigh the evidence of what the needs are and what the resources are and try and balance things out in the best way they can. They're supposed to use their best judgment. I know there are some people who disagree with that. A lot of politicians will say, no, I'm there to represent the people, not do what I want. And they cover it that way, though frankly those politicians are the ones who least likely represent the majority will, but they're more likely to do is represent the vocal will. And if that's a small minority, as it may be on some issues, that's what they're going to represent. They don't care. It may be against their best judgment, it may be against the political will of the majority of the public, but because there's a small group that's very vocal about something and that votes on the issue, they're going to go that direction. But I think it's the duty of a public official to do what they think is right. So I describe the job of working for justice is to persuade them. But certainly the other politicians who don't necessarily believe they should do what they think is right, but what the public wants, there's always the ability to pressure them. And I don't suggest you do this in a negative way in terms of, if you don't do this, I'm going to vote you out of office. I mean, I get all kinds of those letters all the time from people who, if you're not going to support this thing, I will expend every last dime to get you out of office and every spare minute of my time. I got a real threatening postcard on a gun control issue a few years ago from some guy. He signed his name, you could hardly read the thing. but could hardly read his signature, and he gave no return address or anything, just a postcard. If you vote for this bill, I'm going to spend every last dime I have and every spare minute of my time to defeat you. And it was in our Judiciary Committee a couple of days later, and overheard one of my colleagues talking about some letter, and I started asking about it. And yeah, I found out something, and I checked, and there were about 12 of the members of the committee all got the identical postcard from the same person. As a constituent of yours, I'm going to do everything I can to defeat you. So often, in that case, it was turned into a joke, because the guy was clearly not any of our constituents, and realistically couldn't possibly spend every last dime he had on every one of us. It was an idle threat, but even a serious threat, you know, I don't like being talked to in a threatening way, nobody does, and the way you would probably respond is the way most public officials would respond, so threats aren't the way to do it. But clearly, if people get the sense that there's a large block of people who believe something and who really care, they care enough to take the time to contact their elected officials, that may, if it doesn't persuade them, it may pressure them in a positive way, but it pressures them to believe there's some concern about this. And in terms of working for, advocating for justice in the political process, that's a kind of a rare thing. We get all kinds of letters. What are you doing to protect my pension or federal government? We get all kinds of letters on Social Security too, even though at the state level we can't do anything about Social Security. But people are always interested in their concerns. And it's quite seldom, though less, more and more common, that people start writing on behalf of others, a fair system for other people. People who are not themselves going to benefit from passage of some legislation or defeat of some legislation that they are advocating on behalf of or in support of, in opposition to. And so letting people know that there's a group of people out there can change them. They may feel, well, I think most of my constituents disagree with this particular issue, but they understand that 99% of the public doesn't have a clue anything about what that issue is or how they're voting on it. So if they start getting a relatively small number of people who express concern about it, then if they're at all sympathetic to it, it pushes them in the right direction. So certainly contacting somebody and letting them know there's power, there's political support for a position helps. And persuasion is certainly related to that as well. Most often we think, well, politicians have big staffs at the higher levels, they all do. Some state legislators in some states have no staff whatsoever. They may have a secretarial pool that they can turn to type letters, but that's it. They have nothing else available. But most, at the state level, county level, city level, school board level, most public officials see the mail they get. They get the phone messages, if they return them themselves or not, they see what's coming in and where it is. And in a lot of cases, a relatively small number of things lets people understand that there's some political will out there. Because I can count on the fact that if 10 people, 100 people wrote me a letter on something, there's going to be probably 10 times that many people who care about the issue, but 90% of them didn't bother to call or write. So there is kind of a thing where your letter means more than the feeling that one person out of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of constituents cares about it. There's the sense you cared enough to write or call, and that means something. So in persuasion, how does one best go about doing it? Well, certainly everything in this is common sense. How do you contact somebody? You stop by and visit them. You call them. You write them. And the more time and effort you put into your letter, probably the more time they're going to spend in responding to it. I get all kinds of postcards, "Dear Senator, fill in the blank." And I care very deeply about this important issue, and I am counting on your support or opposition to this bill. Sincerely, fill in the blank. They put the postage on it, or some group puts the postage on it for them. It doesn't mean a lot. I mean, I know they didn't really feel that strongly about it if they took the time to write in the name and that was it. But, yes?
If you get a lot of that same letter, does it do...
Does it do more good?
If they have a group and they say, okay, we're gonna have a letter writing thing. If you get a whole bunch of that same thing and they sign your name and address, will it mean anything then?
No, it means something. That's what I'm trying to make, this distinction between persuasion and pressure. I'm not gonna, if I get 200 postcards on the same issue from the same group and so on, I read one, I don't have to read the other 199 to learn something new, but as I said, a whole lot of people go by the pressure thing. And even I, who don't think we should be weighing the mail, oh, I got twice as many who care this way than the other way, it alerts me to something. Boy, a lot of people feel strongly about this. And you ought to pay attention to it, and you ought to find out, is there something to this that I'm not aware of? And so it, aside from the pressure, there still is some persuasion in even a form postcard. But clearly there is the benefit. The question is, if you can only get somebody to take the time to fill in a blank, it's better to do that than not let them know. Politicians don't have ESP and they don't have a clue what you're thinking unless you tell them. And therefore, filling in the blank on a postcard is certainly better than nothing. Phone call is probably no more work than that, and maybe less work and cheaper, and that works too. And you start getting a lot of phone messages, and you start taking notice of that as well. So in terms of persuading somebody, the more attention you put into something, the more that you're going to get back. Somebody writes me and asks me two questions. How do you feel about this? Can you support this? And what about this additional issue? I can't send them a form letter. Well, you probably get some form letters like that if you write to public officials, because they, oh, this goes into that pile, and give them that form response. But a whole lot of, the more you get into it, if you're spending a lot of time on it, don't write in the first paragraph, I want you to support this because, and then 10 reasons, they may not read them. But if it takes them some time to figure out what all your concerns are, there's a little more likely you're going to have some more attention paid to that. Yes?
About the value of phone calls rather than letters. I find it so much easier to pick up the phone and call my lawmakers rather than sitting down and writing a letter. I really find that an obstacle, the letters.
And because of that, more and more people do use the phone, and certainly at a smaller level, state legislative level in most states, again, California and New York and so on are different situations. But in most states, legislators will get the message either way and may return your phone calls, or somebody will return your call, or if you're just saying, I care about this because of this, it gets the same message out as a postcard does, and maybe more, because you can say two sentences and 10 sentences, two paragraphs, whatever you want to tell them, and it only takes you a couple of minutes of time to do it, and it may get, especially at higher levels, you'll get tally one more in support of this or one more in opposition to this. But nevertheless, for the bean counters, who mail weighers, who count them each way, it does draw attention, and so a phone call will do the same thing. And at the smaller level, the hope is, in either case, that you can get through directly and that you're able to talk with the person, give them your rationale. If I talk to a constituent and they say, I want you to support this because it's a good thing. And why do you think it's a good thing? I don't know. I mean, that doesn't do a whole lot. You know, somebody's telling them to do that. And with organized letter writing or phone calling, you kind of get the message. Politicians usually are pretty much able to distinguish one type from the other. And obviously, one individual letter from one person, just because they care about that issue, may get more attention than if it's 100, than any one of 100 postcards or phone calls. But nevertheless, those 100 phone calls create the weight that a lot of people means a lot there too.
It's very frustrating to be a citizen and a voter, and I can see how these campaigns. And I've heard you in another lecture, and I get the feeling that you're obviously in favor of gun control. And take a person who is not in favor of gun control, all right? And he's on the outside. He's ignorant as to what to do. He can shoot off his mouth. He can do all these kinds of things, but he doesn't No, a senator is not approachable. A representative is not approachable by the average individual. They just don't know how to do it. So to get an organization as powerful as the National Rifle Association, who has a lot of power in this way and has a lot of data and ability to do these things, this is a natural avenue for them to say, oh, great, I'll sign this and send this in. And that is what is going on at the lower level.
Right. Oh, I don't disagree. And it makes good sense for people to do that. I was going to later talk about organizations and the importance of working collectively, because while one person writing on their own may have more impact than each of 100 individual postcards, nevertheless, the collective weight of those other things is more weight than one individual. And joining a group like that, working that way, clearly enhances the ability. And the individual citizen is legitimately frustrated that I care deeply about this and they won't listen to me. Well, U.S. Congressmen represent in the average state well over 500,000 people now. If you took the time to even count 500,000 people, it'd take you several days of counting. And if they were all lined up in a row, it'd take that long to just count that many people, let alone hear from them. If each of them had two sentences to tell you every 2 years, you could never hear them all. There's just not enough time in the day to do that. And obviously not everyone takes the time to call or write to do something like that. But you'd have zero time to study any issues, zero time to do anything.
But even to take the, I have never talked to my senator. They're always busy, they're saying this, and then you talk to a person in the office who will come out with a canned talk against why the representative is going to vote the way he is, and it's defeating. You have no idea. You can take, you're in a position right now where I don't know that if I'm going to be conveying to you the frustration of a lot of people because of their ignorance, and I don't use the word ignorance to be demeaning, the lack of knowledge of how to get into this process.
Yeah, well, it is very
elected officials are hardly, at the higher levels, are hardly approachable.
That's very true. It's very hard to approach. I mean, there are two reasons. One of which, some people are just intimidated by the thought of meeting their U.S. senator or something. And second of all, in California, where they represent 40 million people now, there's just no way in the world that they can be approached by everyone. There only are 24 hours in a day, and even politicians need time to spend on their own and to eat and sleep and spend time with family and friends and do other things. So there isn't the time, and that makes it very frustrating for people who feel too small to be heard. And that's why much of organizing, at least at the higher levels, has to be done through organizations. You can't do it on your own. No individual is able to do all this, and the public will be frustrated at that, and there's no, about all you can do is explain it. I frankly think it's nice if a legislative office will not just take down, oh, you're in favor of this or you're opposed to this bill, but will also tell you, if you want to listen, a few sentences on why the individual may disagree with you. That may be better. I think it's better or fairer to the person who's calling rather than just be to, oh, thank you, oh, great, we're glad to hear your concern, which is something they should say, but leaving it just at that doesn't go far enough. I think it's important for a public official to spend some time educating the public as to why they take those stands. I mean, that's part of what the next election's for. If you don't like where somebody is, you vote them out of office. If you don't have a clue where they're coming from, you don't know whether you'd support them or not. Yes?
My understanding of the process, and especially at the federal level, is that's one of the nice things about the staffs that senators and representatives have, is that those people are very important, and yes, it's very difficult to get into the elected official. It's not so difficult to get into their staff, and their staff people, I think we as citizens tend to forget how powerful those people are in helping mold and develop the way that individual votes. So where, no, you cannot have 500,000 people contacting a representative, you certainly have access to their staff.
Right, and just to show, underscore that point of how important the staff is, I know in my case, I listen to a lot of what my staff has to say. I mean, I make up my own mind, but they certainly give advice and other things. And they're the ones who tells me what I'm hearing from other places that I may not hear directly. And that's important to me, I know, but the best way to prove that staff has an impact is look at what lobbyists do, especially at the national level and higher up levels. They don't spend time on the elected officials. Most of them can't get through to them either. They spend time on the staff. And they're very nice to the staff. I mean, my staff gets all kinds of nasty phone calls from people who are outraged that I'll take some position on something. And the lobbyists don't ever yell at a staff person. They're smart. They recognize that you want them on your side. You want to persuade them. And the groups, Connie works a lot with Bread for the World, which does advocacy on hunger and poverty issues. And they spend a lot of time. They have a staff that does lobbying, and they encourage people who are willing to do more than just write an occasional letter or make an occasional phone call to go in and meet with the staff person who deals with that issue or those issues, and they to try and get to know them and explain why you care about it. And that's where you may have the best chance at the higher levels, because you are not going to, in a person holding a statewide office or of a congressional district-sized office or something, there simply isn't the time of the day to do it. So you do it the way that makes the most sense, and that may often be through the staff people. But all of these things are things that are designed to persuade or pressure a public official.
I just have one other comment, and that is another way to get them to be persuaded is to invite them to your organizational's meeting. Have a public forum and invite the whole Twin Cities or the whole community, and then these public officials get to be in the media, they get to see some constituents, you know, and have a dialogue on questions that you have set up that are your justice agenda. And it gets them to come to you, and you can see them face to face.
And politicians do go to groups, and their staff members do. I mean, there's a limited number of hours in the day, and they can't go to everything, and there are too many times you have three invitations for the same minute, and you can't possibly be at all of them. And so it's a lot of choosing and trying to do it, but somebody who is trying to advocate for some cause is wise to try everything they can in terms of creative ways of doing this. And certainly people write letters to the editor, and they try community things that are lobbying the public is one way of persuading public officials. If you change public opinion on something or get the public at large more concerned about an issue, that makes your efforts easier in persuading the public official. But all of these things, whether you're doing them on your own, you'll have some much more limited impact. You have to recognize that the fact that you alone are not changing somebody's mind on something doesn't mean that you have no impact. And in a country with 260 million people, we can't possibly all be the decisive person on every issue. It just doesn't work that way. We'll probably never be the decisive voice on any issue. But recognizing we all play a role in moving that way, and when we're talking about decisions affecting our entire nation or our entire world or our entire community or entire state, those are big decisions, and even having a minor role in pushing something over the top or holding back against something, it makes a big difference. Yes, go ahead.
If the staff is so central to this process, then why are the staff members so invisible in terms of making the public aware that certain members of your staff will deal with their mail or with their telephone calls? And the appearance is that you will have direct contact with the politician in question, whether it's your senator or your assembly person or whatever. So if they play such a central role, then why are they so invisible, so to speak, in terms of not the public not knowing that? And the frustrating thing is, you know that you cast your ballot for the senator, for example, and you want to talk to the senator, Now, if that's not possible, you know the senator's talking to somebody.
Yeah.
So how does all of that get determined? You know, who will you talk to? And who will, you know, just
who are they listening to? Yeah.
Yeah, who are you listening
well,
to?
Well, first of all, it's sort of a two-part question. The first part of it on the why don't we hear that the staff people, who we should talk to. First of all, a lot of congressional offices and so on, higher level offices with big staffs will say, will once in a while put out a newsletter and say, here's the person to contact for this, or call my office and ask for the person dealing with this. They sometimes do that sort of thing, but the main reason you don't hear a whole lot about the staff people is tied to the second part of your question. Who do you vote for? You vote for the elected official. The elected official wants you to know who they are and what they stand for, and frankly, they're the ones who are accountable. If I do something dumb because my staff persuaded me to do something dumb, it may be their fault that that they gave me the information that I based my judgment on and was a lousy decision and nobody likes it and I get voted out of office because of it. But I'm the one who made the decision. I shouldn't hire that staff person if they're incompetent or whatever. I'm the one who is ultimately the one responsible. I'm the one who has to go before the voters, and therefore I'm going to present myself to the voters. And yes, when somebody asks me, how can I get more information on this? Or I've got this problem with that. Or I'd like to give you some more information on this. I will often tell them, call so-and-so in my office. And a one-on-one basis, when I'm there, I will give them my office number, tell them who to call. But I don't print in a brochure, call this, because there's so many thousands of issues. I'm never going to, and I have two-person staff. It's not a big thing or anything. So it's not like, well, I'll call this person for this and this for that. But what I'm trying to say is, oh yes, in New York and in California, they are very large staffs. Some states, as I said, have none. But it is something that the politician, in many of these places, some staff people are around for 20, 30 years, others are around for 1 year at most. And there is heavy turnover in some of those, and therefore the person who's building the relationship with the voter, the constituent, is appropriately the public official. And yes, nobody tells you who to contact, but if you call a senator's office and tell them you want to talk to somebody about this, they'll put you in charge of the in contact with the right person. And if you intend to contact them repeatedly about something, it pays for you to get to know that person's name and try and meet with them. And it's very important to build those contacts there if you can. Who does the public official meet with? How do they spend all their time if they're not speaking to you, and if they don't have time to talk to you? Why aren't I worth it, and why is somebody else worth it? Well, one of the issues that I think is a real problem in our system is special interest groups. And again, I've just told you getting involved with groups makes good sense. But interest groups often have too much clout. And I would suggest it's very appropriate for an interest group that has 20,000 people in it who are contacting you as their U.S. senator about this issue of great concern to them, that person has more access to the person than any one of those 20,000 people on their own. Too much of the system is unfortunately driven by the fact that those lobbyists spend money on the political system, the campaign financing, they spend money courting legislators or public officials in other ways, wining and dining them, other things that the public is pretty aware of, things like that happen. And that's what's inappropriate. Somebody shouldn't have better access because they got more money to pump into the system. They should have access because they represent some interest that needs to be heard. And I don't speak out against lobbyists in any way, saying that they have a right to be heard and their voices, collective voices, should be heard in the political process. My only objection is the fact that money speaks in politics. And I heard somebody who was arguing in favor of campaign finance reform say, if you have 15 minutes in one day in which to return some phone calls and you got 20 phone calls to return and 20 of them are from, this is a congressional case, 20 of them are from your home district, and the 21st one is somebody who contributed $1,000 to you in the last campaign and isn't even from your district. Which one are you going to return first? Well, people being people, they're going to tend to return the one who did them the big favor, gave them the big money first. And that's one of the problems. But simply put, I don't try and say, well, this much of my day I am going to be spending trying to get in touch with whoever is trying to get in touch with me as constituents. I try and get information on the issues I need, sometimes from constituents, sometimes from other. On a crime issue, for instance, I will talk with, if it's a court system thing, I'll talk to people who are active in those issues, people who are familiar with the issues. I'm not going to just at random take a phone call and say, well, what's your view on this? I'm trying to get people who are familiar with it and educated on that particular issue when I need the information. But that doesn't mean that that the constituents aren't particularly different sort of thing that you listen to. But on a particular issue, most of the time you're spending is going to be based on the issues you're working with, and they will tend to be the people who are at the Capitol. They will tend to be lobbyists or administrative officials or a business person who comes in or a labor person who comes in order to testify on some issue. That's what committee hearings are for us to develop some expertise. Yes?
What sort of attention would a personal letter, let's say that I've talked to 15, 20 people at church and they feel the same about an issue that I do, and then I go and I talk out and the people that I'm working with and volunteer associations and so forth, and I got another 50 people, and I say, but I don't have the time to write a letter. And I say, okay, fine, I will write a personal letter to the senator. Will you sign? And then I get, let's say, 50 signatures on it. But this is an individual thing. What kind of reception would that get?
That would have more clout than you writing a letter. It wouldn't have as much clout as if all 50 people wrote letters. Mm-hmm. It's somewhere in between. You get what you put into it almost. Mm-hmm. It suggests, and politicians sometimes forget how everybody else is, everything. They have only 24 hours in their days too, and they all have jobs and families and everything else that takes time too. So everybody's pinched on time, and they don't have enough time to just, any time they feel, oh, that's outrageous, I'm going to write a letter to every elected official who deals with that and complain. I recognize people don't have unlimited time to do that, and therefore the postcard that I was describing at the beginning that didn't take them a whole lot of time, what that tells me is, in their scheme of things, they had a few seconds to fill this out, and somebody probably handed them the postcard, asked them to mail it in, may have pre-stamped it and everything. So it doesn't mean as much as if that person sat down and took the time to write it on their own, but nevertheless, it does mean something, and the petition with 50 names on it suggests, for one thing, it took you more time, and obviously they didn't sign it if they strongly disagreed with you, so we sympathize with your concern. So yes, a petition would do more than, much more than one letter, but not as much as 50 letters or phone calls would. So the more you can get other people to take the time themselves to do it, the more impact you're going to have. I'd like to briefly get to the other side of how you advocate for things that you want, and that is choosing who holds office. And in a democracy, we all have a responsibility to do that, as well as talk to people once they're there. In the most obvious way, which most of us, I hope, do, and that is voting, is certainly important. But like with your point earlier about how you're not even heard when you care about an issue, well, I've heard people say, well, I'm one vote out of so and so many. What difference does that make? Well, there are always all the books that tell people why they should be involved in the political process always point out all the examples of the U.S. Senate seat in New Hampshire being decided by two votes 20 years ago, and John F. Kennedy was elected by less than one vote per precinct nationwide. And there are all kinds of examples of very close races. Obviously, smaller races, they tend to be decided by fewer voters, but even in national elections and statewide elections, there are a number of close ones in which a handful of people do it. And you may say, well, my vote wouldn't have made the difference. Well, your vote and one vote on every block may have made the difference easily. One vote per block. So yes, in that sense, you yourself don't, but there are lots of people who think like you do. And so clearly voting is very important, but moving one step further, voting is one small part of it. Some states use a primary selection process for who the candidates are going to be. Some use caucus convention system. it's much easier to be involved in a caucus convention system than it is the other way. But in either case, selecting who's going to be on the ballot in November is often more important choice than who wins in a lot of people's views, because they don't like any of the choices they have in November. So then the trick is to get involved earlier and decide who's going to be on the ballot in November. Participating more directly in campaigns, volunteering, contributing, all sorts of other things is certainly an important part of that, or even running for office yourself. I think all of those things are important ways of people getting involved, and I like to point out that every citizen, including those who are so frustrated the whole political process, they say, I don't want to have anything to do with it, I'm not going to make my decision known. Even if you choose not to vote, you made at least one political decision, and that's the decision to let somebody else decide for me. And you are active even if you don't vote, you've made one decision. And I think in both of these ways, there's a lot that has to be done in terms of advocacy. Again, this one is specifically advocacy for justice, and there are certainly groups like Bread for the World, Children's Defense Fund on a lot of poverty and children's issues. Lots of local groups. Minnesota has one, Congregations Concerned for Children, that does similar things at the state legislative level. Denominational groups, I know the ELCA has a Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs in Washington that puts out newsletters and information to people. Most of these groups spend a lot of time educating the public, their interested members and so on why they care about such issues and why those individuals ought to care about such issues. And working with those groups makes a lot of sense. There also are a slew of groups, depending on the particular issue, human rights groups, or there's a group, Citizens for Tax Justice, that's working for more progressive tax systems nationally and state by state. But all of these things, there are those groups out there. They are available, and not just invaluable because they provide collective power, but also because they provide information. And that's one of the most important things people need. Trying to pick up information from newspaper and magazine and TV and radio on what's happening in government doesn't give you much. I mean, I often try and find out what's happening. I hear somebody will ask you, what do you know about this issue? When's it coming up? I don't know any more than what I read in the paper, and that's meant to suggest you don't know a lot, because the papers don't spend much time on it, and the rest of the media spends even less than that. So getting information from these groups is very helpful. But with that, I would like to formally stop talking, open it up for discussion, and I know there are a lot more questions. Yes, you first.
When you described yourself, you said you're a senator from Minnesota, and that you're a Christian, and that you're, and then you described the topic today about justice. Now, I'm just interested to know, I mean, when we're talking about lobby groups and all that stuff, what groups like the quote-unquote Christian Coalition, what has been your experience with that, and how, if you're describing yourself as Christian, this is a real problem for me, because that kind of group, I'm a Christian, and I'm not sure how much injustice is happening sometimes. And so how does that work?
Okay, if you're here on Friday, I'm going to be talking more about relationships between religion and politics. And the only thing I'll correct you in what you said is I don't think I described myself as a Christian in introducing myself here. I am a Christian. Maybe I did today because of the nature of the topic and how I'm tying it to relating to justice concerns. Mm-hmm. And I think that we as Christians are to be involved in that. In talking with my constituency, in talking with potential voters, I don't say, vote for me because I'm a Christian, because I don't think that's an appropriate connection to make. I think everything about how I make decisions in the political process comes from what I believe. And what I believe is heavily influenced by my faith, and therefore it has a heavy role to play in it. That's all perfectly appropriate, and I think that's the way it's supposed to work out. I think our faith is supposed to influence every part of our life, not just our worship. What I have problems with, and I think you were alluding to, is when groups come out and say, this is the will of God that you support this bill or whatever. And I think it's very appropriate for churches or any of these groups to be involved in advocating for something. They have to understand what they are saying is if a church or a denomination or whatever is advocating for a position, that's what they are advocating for as a group of people with a common faith belief, and their understanding of the issues leads them to concerns about this, and they see this is the best way to address that injustice or that problem or whatever. You get into real trouble when you start saying this is the will of God, and there are candidates who describe themselves as the Christian candidate, and that causes real problem. What about people who disagree with them? And there's one group, the Christian Voice, that's done morality ratings of members of Congress, and I don't see anything wrong with rating members of Congress. It's helpful to people. All these groups I mentioned do voting records of members of Congress. They may say agreed with our position, disagreed with our position. This one they called them morality ratings, members of Congress. And I remember about the first year they did it was 79 or 80. And they took Father Robert Drynan, back when Catholic priests were involved in politics, he got a 0% rating. And John Buchanan, who's a Baptist minister from Alabama, got a 0% rating and other things like that. And then Richard Kelly, who was the Florida congressman who was convicted in Amsterdam, he got 100% morality rating. If you look at their issues, yeah, if they weren't calling it a morality rating, and if you recognize where the group's coming from, yeah, you could get some useful information out of it. It was a very conservative group that had all kinds of interesting positions that people who you think of as being strong Christians and so on, they disagree with. And they were anti-U.S. Department of Education, which was a controversial issue 15 years ago. Most of us can't even remember why anymore, but it was a controversial issue and they opposed it, and therefore it was an immoral vote in their eyes. So yes, there's a big, I think it's very important that we relate our personal faith with our every part of our lives, including our political decision making, but considering that part of the church and God's will is a different thing. Yes?
When I saw the topic of justice in politics, I looked at justice from the Justice Department, the courts, and I was hoping it'd be dealing with something such as this. Many crimes are committed, people who committed the crimes are convicted, and the terms of their penalties are sometimes very light, if any. I was hoping that from a politician would have some guts and put some strength into these penalties. Let me give you an example. I'm from Wisconsin, and we in the Milwaukee metropolitan area, there's plea bargaining going on like crazy. And to give you an example, Archbishop Cousins, who is in our area, was attacked physically by a man, beat up. He was convicted. The conviction took about 6 months of a lot of legalese, a lot of court trials, and then the judge, in his infinite wisdom, after he was convicted, gave the man 90 days probation. Then there was another site, this is one example, and I'll get to my point when I'm done. The other example is, so five young men, 20 years old, got loaded, went into a cemetery, smashed a lot of cemetery monuments, a lot of damage. And this is an old cemetery. The judge came through and they were all convicted and they were expecting to get a plea bargain also. It happens that legislatively, politicians said it was 9 months for this maximum penalty. Each one of them got several penalties of 9 months consecutively, not all at once. And this shocked them. They thought they were going to get out with a small fine and maybe pay some restitution to the community, like $200 of hours of social services. And here, these are two diametrically opposed decisions. What I'm saying is, why don't the legislators have some guts and put out some penalties that are meaningful? A good example is the drug business is not accelerating like it was, because there's more meat put in to if a person is convicted. It's a mandatory 5 years or 10 years, depending on quantity of or the quality of the drug involved. And you see now, slowly, there is people pulling out of this. They're not having the same In other words, what I'm trying to say is the effect is there because the legislators put some meat into the law and a conviction.
Right. Well, let me respond very briefly to this, and it's one that does take more time than I'm going to be able to give it right now. But first of all, politicians on crime tend to, no politician wants to be known as soft on crime. So when politicians get involved in sentencing, as they've done more and more in recent years, it is always in longer, harsher sentences, and they want to look as tough as they possibly can. And given the fact that that costs a ton of money to lock people up, about most states it averages between $20,000 and $30,000 per year per inmate. Therefore, somebody who does some crime that's going to lock them up 10 years, we're talking $200,000 to $300,000 of tax money just for the locking up of the person, not counting the court costs to convict them and the appeal and so on.
Or the millions of dollars to build new prisons.
Or
they're all.
Yes.